Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. And consider this. Now the Pacific Northwest may have to admit that the laws passed in both Oregon and Washington against natural gas using natural gas-powered electric plants are going to have to go. Those laws may have to simply be overturned because now the Pacific Northwest and its Energy Planning Council says we've got to build some natural gas-powered electric generating plants. And if we don't, we're going to be running out of electricity in the next couple of years. Finally, somebody is planning to do something about it, although it's going to require that both the states of Oregon and Washington, having passed laws effectively outlawing natural gas as a way of generating electricity, those laws are going to have to go. Or you're going to be sitting, depending on the time of year, either sweating or freezing in the dark, because that's what's going to happen. Let me get to the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, where we serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And you're invited to the conversation at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we always put naysayers to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Every day we post a brand new poll. We put it up. It's called the X Poll. You'll find it on X at Lars Larson Show. We also duplicate that on my website at LarsLarson.com. And this is crazy. Although it's the kind of crazy that I kind of expect some school authorities in both Portland and Seattle might be tempted to match. In Detroit public schools, they have now decided to pay kids to show up to school. $100 a week if they end up getting perfect attendance. The Detroit Public Schools Community District is expanding an attendance incentive that officials say may improve turnout. And why is that? Because in Detroit, the city of Detroit now has an absenteeism rate that goes as high as 61% of kids miss at least 10% of the school year. So they've decided if you can't get them to show up because they don't see the value in the education, students in grades 6 through 8 can get $50 a week for each week of perfect attendance, while high school students can earn $100 a week for perfect attendance in schools. So you've got to take something of value for which America pays more money than any other country on this planet. We pay nationwide about $17,000 per student per year. Here in the Pacific Northwest, the numbers in Oregon or Washington are closer to $18,000 or $19,000 per student per year for K through 12 education. And then you've got to pay kids to actually show up. If that makes sense to any of you, should schools pay students up to $100 a week just for perfect attendance? My answer to that is no. If they do not see the value in coming in for this education that taxpayers are already funding at a gigantic level, some of the highest numbers in the United States are paid in Oregon and Washington, and some of the worst results from schools are generated in Oregon and Washington. If you don't want to show up for the education that taxpayers are paying through the nose for, then as far as I'm concerned, good luck. Good luck in your future endeavors. Today's poll on X can be found at Lars Larson Show on X, also at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, about the Pacific Northwest electricity supply. If you've been listening to this show for the last decade, we've been on the air now for about three decades, but if you've been listening over the last decade, you have heard me say time and again that the power planning authorities of Oregon and Washington and Idaho identified a long time ago the region is headed for blackouts. The region is headed for brownouts. It's a thing called loss of load probability, which they used to try to hold below 5%. It was routinely 2 or 3%. That was the chance that the region would run short of electricity and be unable to supply the needs of the people in the Pacific Northwest and the businesses in the Pacific Northwest. And the reason it has to be a loss of load probability or possibility is this. You don't know what the region's weather is going to be. You don't know how hot it's going to get in the summer. You don't know how cold it's going to get in the winter. You don't know how much water will be behind the hydro dams that supply so much of the electric power in the Northwest, although they only supply about half the power that we use in the Northwest. The rest of it has to be generated. What we do know is that the greenies have demanded. You will build solar. You will build wind. We don't have the wires to connect those plants. You will get rid of dams, and they have. You will get rid of coal, and they have. You will get rid of nuclear, and they have. Oh, and by the way, we've passed laws that say you can't build natural gas-powered electric generating plants. It is insanity. Well, guess what? The Northwest Power and Conservation Council has issued its brand new report just a few days ago, and in that, it has an energy blueprint for the four states. They released the draft of its ninth power plan on August 13th. So that's 6 days ago. And what did they find? The power plan proposes to add 1,200 megawatts of natural gas power by 2032. That's 6 years from now. Now, if you follow anything about generating power, you know you don't walk in and get a permit and site a plant and very, very quickly put it together. And yet they're saying we have to have these plants, 1,200 average megawatts, in place within the next 6 years. The last plan that they released just 5 years ago, it didn't call for more natural gas-powered plants. But what they have said is since then, since the last plan in 2021, data centers have come along. Electric vehicles are being pushed. Population growth. And of course, the push from just about every local government in Oregon and Washington to electrify everything. Electrify your car. Electrify your house. Get rid of natural gas. Don't heat water with it anymore. Don't do any of that. The power plan calls for 9,000 megawatts of renewable energy, 5,000 megawatts of stored energy, batteries. That's going to cost an arm and a leg. And if you don't think that your power rates are already going up and they're going to go up gigantically, then you haven't been paying attention. Seattle is seeing it. Portland's seeing it. All of the Northwest is seeing it. And this is even as natural gas has become one of the most affordable kinds of energy that's available. And yet, Oregon has a law that says it is illegal to build a large natural gas-powered electric plant. It is illegal to expand an existing plant. And Washington utilities, they've been told you can only use natural gas to supply 20% of the electricity, and it's supposed to be entirely gone by 2045. So, like I said, if they don't change those laws and those new natural gas-fired electric plants are not built, then a lot of us here in the Pacific Northwest are going to end up either freezing to death or sweating in the dark, because that's what's going to happen. And your power is going to be gobbled up by places like data centers and population growth. It is Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next. Home, but it needs some work.
If you don't want to talk but want to be heard, email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right, you know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, the wreckage of the Centennial Mills warehouse offers a golden opportunity for Portland City Hall to demonstrate. whatsoever what to do to fix the city's problems. Consider the history leading up to the fire 2 weeks ago and the explosive end for the building on Monday. Portland paid almost $8 million for that property more than a quarter of a century ago. And as usual, it promised glorious development plans. That's what governments always do. Even though most of the people who are elected to government, most of the people who work in government have no successful track record of development at all. But they'll always tell you they know how to do it. Why? Because they write the permits. It then sat on the property, the city of Portland did, for the next 24 years, and they did absolutely nothing with it. Paid almost $8 million for it, and then sat on it for 24 years. 2 years ago, it sold the 4 acres and the buildings for just over $1 million, a $7 million loss. Buy high, sell low seems to be the city of Portland's mantra. Then for the last 2 years, the city punished developer James Casper, who planned to throw a bunch of money at turning the building into a prosperous business. He walked away a few months ago. The city just kept making demands that had nothing to do with financial reality until Casper finally gave up and walked away earlier this year. Casper says the fire that finally sealed Centennial's fate would not have happened had the city let him do the development. And I think there's good logical reasons to believe that. Portland could do a full mea culpa about now, admit that its sins brought about the destruction of that property, and then announce how Rose City Hall plans to fix the problem. Yep, when pigs fly, that's likely to happen. Glad to get you your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's really causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Jim Jenkins writes in, Lars, I read that there's now a state legislator who wants a two-strike law in Washington state for juveniles caught with firearms. That's down from 4 right now, but there's concern it could harm juveniles of color. That means the compromise will be more restrictive laws against law-abiding gun owners. I'm not a smart Washington state lawmaker, but how about a one-strike rule where we intervene in these kids' lives? Signed, Jim Jenkins. Jim, I couldn't agree with you more. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Well, I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to the homeless burglar who, get this, broke into a man's business, threatened him, tried to steal from him, and then when the owner of the business, who happened to be sleeping there overnight, the burglar woke him up at about 5 o'clock in the morning. He shot the burglar 3 times. Didn't kill him, but shot him. The criminal then sued the owner of the business for $10 million. Props and kudos to the Multnomah County jury, who decided very quickly yesterday to award $0 to the criminal for his trouble. And the fish wrapper headline was priceless. Portland jury awards $0 to homeless burglar after owner throws a cup of urine in his face and then shoots him 3 different times. I thought one of the unintentional ironic parts of the story was this. The city had actually threatened the owner of this business. He was trying to save some money by sleeping in his business at night. And they said, you're not allowed to sleep there. Imagine the irony in a city like Portland or Seattle or any of the other Northwest cities that tolerate thousands and thousands of people sleep in any damn place they want to sleep. And yet, if you own a business, don't you dare sleep in that business overnight. You know, we'll go after you. It's not zoned for that. Can you believe that nonsense? Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go to the head of the line. Our favorite post on social media, Britt Storkson in the Dalles writes, Lars, this California ban on certain kinds of tires is a tried and true socialist scheme whose only objective is to extract money from one segment of society, usually the working class, and give it to another. This ban will limit the amount of tires being sold in the state, meaning quasi-monopolies on tires. It's going to raise prices. Typically, the promoters of this ban are aligned with whoever the tire supplier is. And a portion of the money generated goes back to the politicians in the form of campaign contributions. Signed, Britt. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Let me check in with George. George, what's on your mind today?
Hi there, Lars. Of course we should pay kids $100 a week to go to school. If they don't show up to school, where else are they going to get indoctrinated? Where else are they going to learn that communism is good and capitalism is bad? Where else are they going to learn that perfectly normal little boys are really little girls in making?
So you got to pay them to show up for indoctrination, right?
Yeah, you got to show them to pay them for indoctrination. That's the only way to go, Lars.
Unbelievable. The idea that taxpayers would be on the hook for the better part of $20,000 a year, it's almost to that number now, and that we have to then pay kids to actually show up for it. The heck with that. I've got some other ideas on how to solve the absenteeism problem. Let's go to Bill. Hey, Bill, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Wednesday, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I was thinking about the same thing there with the whole paying for schooling here. So if I've got this straight, not only has our esteemed Queen Governor Krocek said we're going to suspend the requirements for people to pass through grades,
yep,
and we also pay the Oregon Education Association insane amounts of money, as well as Portland teachers, yet we end up 49th and 50th in the country in math and reading proficiency for third graders.
All
so
that true.
The solution is we're going to take and pay an extra $100 to teach kids, like the previous caller said, to be activists. This is a good example of why we really do need to try to push more and more for not only school choice, but letting the tax dollars go with the kids. And one of the things that's really sad that I started finding out here only in the last couple of years, when our federal government takes and decides that it wants to take and calculate what it needs for prison bed space,
yeah,
they go on a 10-year curve, and they look at risk factors for third and fourth graders, such as education rates.
And by the way, they're already forecasting the number of school kids in Multnomah County is going to go down by 17,000 in the near future, all while they're building hyper-expensive brand-new schools for students who aren't even there. It's Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you've got the Lars Larson
Show. The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather. Interviews, podcasts, local and national news. Get it all at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So, Oregon has a brand new health chief who's accused of knowing about years of alleged sexual abuse at another state agency. Why is he now running the state's largest such agency? That would check in with Nigel Jake, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for Willamette Week. Nigel, have I characterized this situation properly the way you've covered it in the Oregon Journalism Project piece you wrote?
Yes, you have. Fairbors Parakesh, I'm sorry, I'm mispronouncing his name, no doubt, was named last month to head up OHA, which is by far the state's largest agency in financial terms. And he is a named defendant in a number of pending lawsuits against the Oregon Youth Authority, which is the state's juvenile corrections agency. Basically, these lawsuits, they're representing about 125 former inmates in custody. Say that for decades, the doctor at McLaren Youth Correctional Organization Institution in Woodburn was sexually abusing boys, that everybody knew about it, that it was the subject of numerous written grievances, complaints. It was referred to the state police, to the Department of Human Services, to the Oregon Medical Board, and nothing was ever done to stop it.
Well, and in fact, it seems like one of those situations where if the folks in charge decided this really is the best person to put in that job, that they would also want to explain, oh, and by the way, if you're wondering why we're putting him in charge when, in fact, he may have been in a position to know about this abuse that may have gone on for as long as 17 years, offer some kind of explanation to the taxpayers and maybe to the rest of the staff there about why you'd put this person in such a position of responsibility when there are still questions about what did he know and when did he stop knowing it.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me. Part of the larger issue here, and I've written a number of stories now about this, is the state continues to pay out very large legal settlements for, in essence, bad employee conduct. And bad employee conduct is sort of the responsibility of top management. So if you have top management that is overseeing bad conduct that's costing the state tens of millions of dollars, you'd think you would do two things: get rid of the management and change the employee conduct. But the state doesn't seem to get that message, to the point, Lars, where the state insurance fund, which is basically a pool of money that they set aside to pay these settlements, is absolutely broke.
They're broke. So they've run out of money. So that means the next group they'll have to go to is just the general fund of the state to if there are damages that are owed by a state agency.
Yes.
Wow.
Part of what I report in this story is that what's really unusual here is that there are many sexual abuse cases you and I have covered over the years.
Yep.
It's a little bit uncommon. In fact, a leading lawyer told me very uncommon to have 13 former employees of the state, of the Oregon Youth Authority, step forward and say, yes, we heard about this. We tried to do something about this, but our efforts failed. Top management knew about it. Many times sexual abuse cases are the victim's word against the alleged perpetrator's word, and it's hard for a judge or jury to figure out who's telling the truth. In this case, you have 13 former employees who said the former inmates are telling the truth, and this was a cover-up. And that's,
well, and in fact, I'd add to that, if you're a former employee and you say, I'm going to file this complaint, I mean, there's nothing in it for you, is there? I mean, there's no,
absolutely.
Oftentimes I'll look at some and somebody will say, oh, this happened, but there's something in it for them. They stand to gain in either professionally or in dollar signs into their bank account. But in this case, these 13 former employees, they really have not much of anything to gain by doing this, do they?
No, they have nothing to gain. And you know, Lars, their statements, which were filed in U.S. District Court last month, are devastating. I mean, there are doctors who signed statements. There are nurses. There's a psychologist. There are people who, you know, who spent years and years in this system trying to blow the whistle, and nobody listened to the whistle.
And when you get the statement that says, despite the many grievances against Dr. Edwards, OYA, Oregon Youth Authority, never fired or disciplined Dr. Edwards because he was the chief medical officer for juveniles and he was inexpensive. So he was cheap.
He was cheap then. You know, look, who knows? Anything could happen. They're going to mediation at the end of this month. It has the appearance of a very, very large mistake that was made by not correcting this, by not firing this doctor and referring him for prosecution. He's dead
okay,
now.
I know I'm going to mangle the name too, but doctor, is it Paksharesk? In any case, I made my best effort. Why in the world would Governor Kotek call this guy out of retirement to serve as interim director instead of somebody who's entirely untainted by any of what has gone on at OYA?
Well, I did put that question to the governor's office, and as you see in the story, they declined to answer it. I don't know. I've heard from agency employees at the Oregon Health Authority who have the very same question. That there's been constant turnover at that agency in the upper ranks. I mean, look, there are a lot of smart people in this state who know a lot about healthcare and know a lot about leading large agencies. He's not the only guy she could have found.
No, and in fact, if you're looking for an administrator, maybe even look into law enforcement. I mean, is it possible you could get somebody who says, yeah, we're going to bring in somebody, and he used to head up the, you know, sexual prosecuting sex offenders or something. Put somebody in there who knows something about the problem, at least to lend some credibility to that you're trying to clean the situation up, instead of, it sounds like, Governor Kotek is doing the one thing that would assure everybody it's going to be business as usual and nothing's going to change.
It has that appearance that it's status quo, and the fact that this guy led an agency that's about to cost the state a very large amount of money through mismanagement and terrible behavior, that there's no consequence for that. In fact, there's a reward.
And in fact, let me ask you this. When the state is doing effectively its own, you know, it is its own insurer. They're not doing an outside insurance agency. So if they're having to pay their own claims, wouldn't you think they'd have people in risk management who would come in and say, anytime we found a problem that generated a lawsuit and a payout, we're going to have you change your procedures to make that less likely to happen again. except the, if the state is its own insurance agency, they have no incentive to do that, do they?
Well, that's the way it feels. I mean, you know, I mentioned in the story they just wrote a $49 million check to Oregon Department of Corrections inmates for being mistreated during COVID. In 2023, they wrote a $40 million check to families whose children suffered child abuse while under DHS supervision. The list goes on, and it doesn't appear that the state has made effective moves to try and minimize these terrible outcomes.
No, it doesn't. Hey, Nigel, thank you very much. That's Nigel Jaques, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from Willamette Week. He also writes for the Oregon Journalism Project. His story you can find at WWeek.com. Should Oregon's new health chief, accused of knowing for years about alleged sexual abuse at a state agency, why is he now running one of the largest agencies in the state? And why did Governor Kotek make that kind of decision? Well, the voters can remind her. Lord in Oregon or
if you're surrounded by Northwest liberals,
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails, the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, a lot of times in the last few months, we've been talking about businesses that are packing up and moving out. Well, except in this case, the business isn't moving that far, and it's moving to a much better facility. The business is called Nosler. They're one of the most high-end bullet makers in America, and I'm proud to say that I own a couple of rifles made by Nosler, and I've shot with their bullets, their ammunition, in days gone by. John Nason joins me now, who's Director of Business Development at Nosler. Mr. Nason, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm good, Lars. Thanks so much for having me on your show today. I appreciate it.
So 70 years in the bullet business and a little bit in firearms, but mostly in making high-end ammunition. Why are you packing up from Bend and moving off to Redmond? What's the reason?
Well, it's real simple. We need more room. As the company has grown and our products continue to spread across the country and across the world, we just need more space to make them. And our little buildings in Bend just started getting really, really much too small. So in, was it 2011 years ago, the company decided to purchase 60 acres here in Redmond by the airport for future expansion. I don't think anyone thought the future expansion was going to be this quick, but it's right time, right place. So we are right in the heart of it right now. We're moving the entire, all of everything that we do to Redmond, which we should be operational here shortly.
So you build a brand new facility there, and it's going to be what, 10 times bigger than your old facility? There's that much demand for your product?
Well, it's not as, it has a lot of room for future growth, and they've built the buildings that way to just keep going. But the best thing it does is it gives us efficiencies for technology that we, that no one ever even saw possible 30 or 40 years ago. You know, before when every single thing was handmade, on lathes, it was very easy to just run down the same track and go out the same door. But as we've brought on new product lines and started making suppressors and get into rifles and start getting contracts with the military, that product line continues to expand. So we need more room to continue to do that. So, and not as much a much bigger building, but a much bigger process in efficiencies. In one door, out one door.
Sorry about that. I'm talking to John Nason from Nosler, which is located in Central Oregon. They're moving from Bend to their new facility on 60 acres in Redmond. You mentioned the military. I guess I'm a bit surprised, but I've always thought of you as high-end hunting ammunition, but can you say what it is you supply to the military, or would you have to kill me after you told me?
Well, I couldn't reach you right now, but I probably shouldn't say much. I wasn't given permission to even talk about that. I didn't ask, but we do, you know, we have some of the best bullet designers on the world that work here, and they've worked here a long time. And so oftentimes they're sought out for their talents, whether it comes to, you know, penetrating or accuracy. It doesn't matter what it is, but we usually get a shot at it, and whether we'll take it or not, because we are relatively small compared to most of our competitors, because we still do focus on very much handmade high end. But some of those groups out there around the world, the military, they also need handmade high-end. So I can go that far at least.
So you can say handmade high-end. Can you say 50 BMG or 308 or any of the other things that might tell us a bit more about where these things are going to go?
We don't make anything above a 338.
So you haven't gone to the 50 yet? Okay. All right.
No, sir. I think that's above my pay grade. I do know how much I know how expensive the others shoot, so I would imagine that ours would be even more expensive because it would be made with such high quality.
And you also mentioned technology. So how has technology changed the business of making bullets that's been around for a couple of hundred years?
Well, just the simple fact of storing our data digitally is one thing. I mean, we can now, instead of, I can't tell you how many file cabinets I was staring at last week that we had to figure out what to do with 80 years of paperwork, of first edition render drawings and stuff like that. Not only the efficiency of being able to store stuff, which means the efficiency of being able to find information much more quick, but computer technology, the smaller the microchips get, the smaller the machines get that we need those microchips for. So there's a ton of technology here that I would be quite honest, that I don't even understand, because we have so many, they know all that. We have so many bullet nerds that work here that really are focused on always pushing the envelope on bullet design. So
they don't mind being called bullet nerds, John?
I don't know if they mind, but they are the smartest people that I know, and I think that's a testament to them, because these are the guys that are 3D printing our first runs before they go in, and you know, they're molded and they're made 50 times before they're ever shot through a rifle. So it's pretty fascinating to watch those guys work and the things that they think about, which you and I and most people would never think about.
No, and in fact, when they get those, it was MOA, and they get it down to where you can make a bullet, and they're identical bullets, but they will hit within tiny fractions of an inch of each other in a target 100 or a couple hundred yards away.
Yeah, and make a million of those in one day, and that's the same exact tolerances that we have to not only give out to our hunting public. Those guys that spend that much money on a box of Accubonds or partitions, they expect all 20 of those bullets to act exactly the same to that rifle. And it's the same for the government. I think anytime we put a bullet out, the family, everyone here knows that we don't know what one bullet's going to go in what firearm, whether it's going to be in a police officer's SWAT rifle or an 11-year-old's first-time elk hunt. But both of those are really important to the company, that every bullet that's made here counts. And that's one of the things that we go by. We never know where it's going to go, but we have to make sure that we assume that every round is important to the person that's shooting it.
And you're making suppressors now, too. You mentioned that. Can you tell my audience, because suppressors are important, and they are not like you see in the movies. They don't get rid of all the sound, but they're important as a tool, and now they're a lot more available because of the changes in the rules.
Yes, the rule change was, I think it was a long time coming. It was great. If you've shot suppressed before, you understand how much more enjoyable it is for the, not only the recoil, but the sound dampening. It just makes shooting a loud or a large caliber rifle much more enjoyable. We have been making suppressors for a few years now. It is not our number one thing, but we do make them in-house here in Redmond, and they've been being made in Redmond for some time. We have all titanium version, and we have a titanium aluminum version that is more marketed towards the hunter. So they're very light. They're not designed to go on a full auto gun. Those hunting suppressions that we make are designed to be packed in.
You bet. That is John Nason. John is with Nosler, NOSLER. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.
In 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now,
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. I want to talk about wildfires, but we're going to differentiate between the kind of fires that you see that are grass fires and the kind of fires that are fires, crown fires, fires in the trees. And there is a reason to make a distinction between one and the other. And the guy who knows that best is Dr. Bob Zybak, president of Northwest Maps Company, author of several books, most recently the Zybak Forestry Anthologies, currently running as a four-county commissioner in District 5 in Lane County. Dr. Zybak, welcome back.
Thanks, Lars. And I've got to tell you, I lost the primary, so I'm not running for office anymore. My political career is in the rearview mirror.
Okay, fair enough. We'll put it where it belongs, but I wish the people of Lane County had been able to have you serve them. But you think that the Oregon Department of Forestry is actually using some deceptive numbers when they describe the fires that we've already seen so far this summer. Would you mind telling the audience why?
Well, it's not so much deception. It's just a matter of providing accurate information. When we say we've got over 2 million acres of wildfire, and the biggest wildfire is called the Big Grass wildfire, there's a huge difference between a grassland fire, which is related more to grazing permits, and in which the fire restores the vegetation. If you have a shrubland, such as a berry patch or grasslands, and a fire goes through and you do it on purpose, as the sheep herders used to do, as the Indians used to do, it rejuvenates the vegetation. Whereas if you have a crown fire, as we had on the Labor Day fires, an acre of crown fire causes millions of dollars worth of damage, whereas a grassland fire, the main cost is inattention to it. And so if you've got an acreage figure that accounts a grassland fire, which should have been done on purpose for cheap to the advantage of grazing, and the grazing is not allowed, and we have a wildfire as a result, that's an entirely different animal than a crown fire in conifer forest, and particularly when they don't salvage the trees afterwards. It's just the opposite. A crown fire kills all the major vegetation, millions of wildlife. A grassland fire rejuvenates the vegetation, and it's and in both instances it's basically a root cause of mismanagement. But they shouldn't be lumped together as indicative of a major wildfire year when most of the acreage being measured is grass.
Okay, so in the past, has ODF reported it differently and made a distinction between grass fires and forest fires?
Not so much, but they didn't used to report these figures so much because we didn't used to have wildfires at all. Then they invented wildlands, what we used to call the woods and ranches and farmlands and pasture lands. Now they're called wildlands, and they started lumping the acreages together. So this is kind of a recent thing. And then we start graphing how many of these acres burned. And it's apples and oranges, literally. If it's a crown fire and there's a million acres of crown fires, as we did had on the Labor Day fires, that's a real disaster, real catastrophe. If it's 100,000 acres of grassland and we don't spend a lot of unnecessary money on it, it doesn't damage any structures or anything, it's typically beneficial.
Well, and is it fair to say that the minute we get the fall rains falling on those lands where the grass is burned up, that there's going to be new vegetation come up almost immediately, isn't there?
Yep. That's why the sheep herders used to burn the open prairie lands that the Indians left behind. But a lot of that's become, in the Cascades particularly, the Forest Service used to give grazing permits. We didn't have these wildfires, not to the extent we have now. A lot of those lands filled in once they took away grazing with lodgepole, which are highly flammable. They're like the Douglas fir. They are real pitchy. And when they grow in close proximity to one another, forming a contiguous fuel, then you have crown fires. And so that's a real problem that we haven't really addressed.
Okay, so can you address this, though? Talk to my audience about the roadless rule and how that is not really protecting old growth. If that's what people in the cities care about, they hear about old growth, they want to protect old growth, is the roadless rule doing what people thought it should do?
It's doing just the opposite. I think most people just don't realize that the roadless rule is a de facto wilderness creation by Clinton in about 22, 23 years ago, and that said essentially the same thing, that if you have a fire in a roadless area, it's beneficial somehow or other, and you can't salvage, you can't put in roads. And so following a Crown fire, you have more fuel than you did before the fire. So the roadless rule, the Forest Service put out a report just last year that in the last 25 years on old growth, 9,000 acres was logged of old growth. So that's what they want to stop. But 180,000 acres, a lot of it in roadless areas and wilderness, died because of bugs and disease, and 700,000 acres burned. So you got old growth, people protecting old growth with roadless areas and wilderness, and they're systematically destroying the old growth. So the fires we've been having and the reburns we've been having are unprecedented. There's never been this much fuel on the ground. People burnt the areas regularly for thousands of years. They grazed them for 100, 200 years, and now we've abandoned them. We've said that essentially humans are pathogens. We can't have roads. We can't have access. And we're destroying our landscape as a result. I
mean, okay, is President Trump talking about, is President Trump's Forest Service talking about getting rid of that roadless rule or changing it dramatically?
That would be wonderful. But then what do we do with the millions of acres of snags we have? And so you were talking earlier about natural gas as being good for electrical generation. We could put in cogeneration facilities in a lot of these rural areas and begin systematically removing the snags, which are an increased wildfire risk from what we had while they were green.
Cut them and turn them into hog fuel, right?
Yes, turn them into electricity. We need more electricity in the grid. The rural areas, it would be an independence. It would create thousands of jobs, and it would resolve a lot of this wildfire risk and repeat fires that we've been experiencing the last 20 years.
Well, Dr. Zybeck, I hope that that's what's going to happen, because right now you've pointed out, and I keep pointing out as you have, because I tell people where I got the information, 30 years from the mid-50s to the mid-80s, one large fire north of 100,000 acres. Now we routinely see more than 500,000 acres burn in Oregon, another 500,000 acres burn in Washington. And then, of course, when you add in all the grasslands and you get to give the big headline number for the news coverage to say, oh, we've burned millions of acres. Well, if you count the grass along with the trees as though they're the same, but they're really not. That is Dr. Bob Zybeck, president of Northwest Maps Company, the author most recently of the Zybeck Forestry Anthology, and he formerly ran for Lane County Commissioner for District 5. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lawrence Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. If you're losing it and